From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, as investigations continue into the cause of Gulf War Syndrome, we talk about the history of chemical and biological weapons, including tests that the U.S. military conducted on unsuspecting Americans. We talk with Leonard Cole, author of The 11th Plague, The Politics of Biological and Chemical Warfare. Also, we meet artist Jim Dine, who first became known for creating a form of performance art with Klaus Oldenburg that became known as Happenings. Although he was considered an early pop artist, his work has proved to be quite versatile. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Electric power is slowly returning to parts of the Northeast. The blackout was caused by an early winter storm that struck over the weekend. Susan Millerick is with Northeast Utilities in Berlin, Connecticut.
It was a very heavy, wet, dense snow, so when it fell on the trees, it just stuck there, and when it fell on the power lines, it just stuck there, and the weight of the trees leaning into the lines, the trees broke, a lot of limbs broke, a lot of whole trees fell over on the lines, and that brings them down. We had thousands of spans of wire down.
About 60,000 customers are still without power in Massachusetts. Many schools are closed, and driving is hazardous because traffic lights are not always working. Customers in Connecticut, Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Rhode Island are affected. Some crews from Canada have even been called in. The FBI has scheduled a news conference in Atlanta this afternoon, hoping to find more information about who planted the bomb that exploded during last summer's Olympic Games. NPR's Kathy Lohr reports.
Federal agents are expected to bring with them a reconstructed version of the package, actually a knapsack, which contained the pipe bomb. They will show photographs of the bag's location at Centennial Park. A recording of the emergency 911 call, which warned about the impending explosion, is to be played for the first time in public, and the FBI is expected to offer a reward of $500,000 for information about the bombing. Since federal authorities cleared Richard Jewell, the former security guard who first spotted the package, the FBI has been criticized for its handling of the Olympic bombing investigation and for leaking information to the press. Some say today's briefing is part of an effort to address questions now coming from congressional committees, which plan to hold their own hearings into the matter. I'm Kathy Lohr in Atlanta.
Several hundred Palestinian students have broken into the campus of Hebron University in the West Bank. They defied an Israeli order closing the school 9 months ago. NPR's Eric Weiner reports.
About 300 Palestinian students and teachers broke into the campus of Hebron University this morning, determined to study, even, they said, if it meant clashing with Israeli troops. Israel is insisting the students leave the campus and has ordered additional soldiers to the scene. But according to Israel Radio, the standoff may soon be over. The students have reportedly agreed to leave the campus if Israel agrees to allow a limited class schedule. Israel closed Hebron University in March after a wave of suicide bombings killed nearly 60 Israelis. Israeli officials said the university was a stronghold for Hamas, the radical Islamic group behind the terrorist attacks. The town of Hebron is the last West Bank city still under Israeli control. This is Eric Weiner in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 38 points at 6,419. This is NPR. Authorities in Suffolk County, New York, have taken a man into custody who held hostages on a Long Island Railroad train this morning. The officers say the suspect was in custody about half an hour after the initial call of the situation. Hostage negotiators had responded to the scene. It's not clear how many people were aboard the train or whether more than one car was involved. It is also not clear if the man was armed. China's defense minister is in Washington for high-level talks. U.S. officials say they'll discuss issues like Taiwan, arms sales, and human rights. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
The Defense Department accorded General Chuhao Tian full military honors on the lawn facing the Potomac River. That's customary for defense ministers, but in his case, somewhat controversial. Some members of Congress say the reception's inappropriate because General Chu was in charge of Chinese troops during the 1989 massacre of demonstrators in Beijing. The high-level visit and reception with honors is the latest example of the Clinton administration's commitment to improving relations with China. General Chur was scheduled to visit the U.S. twice before, but the trips were put off due to eruptions between Washington and Beijing. U.S. officials say General Chur's visit is an exchange for Defense Secretary Perry's trip to China 2 years ago. I'm Vicki O'Hara in Washington.
The world's largest meeting on free trade is happening in Singapore. Ministers from 128 nations are talking over several proposals, including a U.S. one that would end tariffs on telephones, information technology, and financial services in 3 years. The United States says this would be a major step in building a global economy. But developing nations say the deadline by the year 2000 is too soon. Other issues include China's request to join the World Trade Organization and a cut in agricultural tariffs. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Thousands of Gulf War veterans are sick, with symptoms including chronic fatigue, rashes, digestive disorders, and memory loss. Many of these vets believe they were exposed to Iraqi chemical or biological weapons. A special White House panel investigating the claims has written a draft of their final report, which concludes there is overwhelming evidence that chemicals were released when American troops blew up an Iraqi ammunition depot in March of 1991. But military logs for the week in question are missing. Last week, General Norman Schwarzkopf and General Colin Powell said they had never seen any confirmed reports of the release of Iraqi chemical or biological agents. My guest Leonard Cole is an expert on the politics of biological and chemical warfare and author of the new book, The 11th Plague. We asked him about the toxins that may have caused Gulf War syndrome.
Initially, when numbers of Gulf veterans started complaining about a variety of symptoms, they were first attributed to stress, post-traumatic stress disorder, moved on to the possibilities of parasite infections, a disease called leishmaniasis, right across to the possibility of pollution from the oil wells and the fires that were burning, and then on to the possible exposure of chemical and biological agents themselves. Now, among the chemical agents that we know that Iraq had in its arsenal were sarin gas, which happens to be the same agent that was used by the cult Aum Shinrikyo in the Tokyo subway system last year. Sarin, tabun, which is another of the nerve agents, they had mustard. So any of the many that we know that were in the Iraqi chemical arsenal could have been released. More than likely, the evidence is that if any of these materials were released, it was not during actual combat by way of Iraq firing these weapons, but more likely after the fighting was over and the stockpiles of these weapons was being destroyed, that some of this stuff wafted into the air and caused some exposure. Do we know that this caused any of the ailments that the veterans now are apparently suffering from? It is not clear. The jury is out.
What is the correlation between the symptoms that the veterans have and the after effects of the chemicals that you've mentioned?
Yes. By the way, I must also mention that there's a chemical called pyridostigmine bromide, which was used as a preventive antidote. Many, many troops, in fact, as many possibly as 400,000 of the troops, took these pills that were given by the Army, which presumably would have helped them resist the effects of certain nerve agents had they been exposed to them. One of the sad problems is that the Army kept no records of who received the pyridostigmine and how many. Some of the troops took them for a day or two, some of them for several months. That also has been seen as a possible cause of the Gulf War syndrome. That is the possible side effects of this material. What are the symptoms? The symptoms range from rash to muscle fatigue to lack of coordination to memory loss, a whole range. Now, how does this coordinate with the possible exposure of actual chemical agents? Well, in a very concentrated form, most of the chemical agents, the nerve agents in particular, would kill the person in a matter of minutes. That is, a tiny drop can actually soak through your clothing if you don't have protective outerwear or if you inhale it, and you would be dead in a minute or two in most cases. So there isn't much time to talk about symptoms. But if you get a moderate exposure, that is, exposure to less concentration or an impure mix of the material, then you initially start with a headache and vertigo. Your body fluids start to secrete. You'll tear a lot. You can feel nauseated. You begin to see different colors. Actually, it really shuts down your nervous system. And so the effects that would be noticeable could range with to cause a really a variety of symptoms, some of which were those that were reported by the veterans. On the other hand, a person can suffer from chronic fatigue and from muscle disorder and imbalance for reasons beyond just a chemical exposure.
How much research has there been done on low-level exposure to these chemical agents?
You hit a very good point there. Virtually none. We don't know, I don't know of any long-term research, that is research for long-time effects of low-level exposure. The presumption had been that unless you were affected quite early on by an exposure to nerve agent in particular, or to mustard, then you would not likely have any long-term effects. That's a presumption. I'm not aware of any scientific studies that have indicated that, that people who had been exposed to low levels then were observed for years after.
I guess I'm wondering if it's possible, or if anybody knows, whether low-level exposure to chemical agents would register immediately in physical symptoms, or whether that low-level exposure might register only slowly over time.
We're getting some hints that the latter of what you suggest is possibly true, that there may be some registration over time. Our understanding until now was that if you didn't get effects early on, you probably wouldn't be getting effects ultimately. And the reason is that the nerve agents work by interrupting the transmission of sensations through your nervous system. And this interruption is relatively short-term. That is, if it's interrupted in a near standstill state, then you're going to be dead in a few minutes. If it's moderately interrupted, you'll have symptoms fairly early on. But then the material itself, the nerve agent, and then the effects of it dissipate, if you're still alive, to the extent that the original chemical that was there is no longer going to remain in an effective form. It breaks down after a period of time. So it does seem unlikely that 2 or 3 years after exposure, one should first develop some of the symptoms that might be expected from short-term exposure. But again, there's no, I mean, especially with the Gulf War veterans, if their complaints are valid, then this whole question really bears careful looking at.
Leonard Cole is my guest, and he's written a new book called The 11th Plague, The Politics of Biological and Chemical Warfare. You describe the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s as the dividing line on biological and chemical warfare issues. Why?
Well, a lot of what we look at today as seemingly contemporary problems, like the questions about Gulf War syndrome, whether Iraq is still concealing information about its chemical and biological programs, the dangers of terrorism, they really weren't the kinds of issues that we would be talking about had it not been for the war between Iran and Iraq, which took place between 1980 and 1988. The last 5 years of that war, we knew at the time and clearly now have confirmed repeatedly, Iraq was using chemical weapons against Iran extensively. So for a 5-year period, long-term, heavy dose, heavy usage of chemical weapons ultimately seemed to have made an outcome, caused the outcome of that war insofar as the Iranians felt that that they couldn't face up to this anymore. The chemicals were frightening. They were debilitating, not only physically, but psychologically. And the general military understanding is that the chemical weapons that Iraq had used governed the outcome of that war. Now, that was a terrible, terrible lesson on many counts, because the only time previously that chemicals had ever been used in large measure was during World War I, back between 1914 and 1917. Then the major powers, first one to introduce the weapon were Germany, but then all the major powers who were involved in that war did use chemical weapons. The effects were so horrible, that is, the way people died, these tortured deaths, frothing at the mouth, bleeding from the nose, and the agony, some of whom suffered agonies for the rest of their lives as a consequence of chemical exposure. The effects on the people's minds who knew about these things were so awful that in 1925, the world's nations got together and created an international treaty called the Geneva Protocol. And they banned the use of chemical weapons and bacteriological weapons in war. And that treaty pretty much held. There were occasional infractions. Some countries here and there did use some chemical or biological weapons. But there were hundreds of wars and skirmishes between the time of World War I and then the time of the 1980s when Iraq used these weapons. During that time, there was a pretty good taboo about this. These weapons were seen as beyond the pale.
So Iraq broke the taboo, and you're saying the world allowed that to happen?
Yes. The United States, the European countries, other Asian countries, they let Iraq get away with chemical murder with, it seemed to me, a minimal amount of foresight about where this was going to lead, because the consequences, while not surprising, have been terrible. Many, many countries, especially poor countries that can't develop what they would call the real atomic bomb, now started going for these pseudo-atomic bombs, or as they've been called, the poor man's atomic bombs. So that while in the early 1980s we suspected that as many as a dozen countries might have had chemical weapons programs, now our intelligence officials tell us that at least 25 countries have them, and that in 1980 and 81, the U.S. publicly accused only one country of having a biological weapons program. That was the Soviet Union. Now we think that there may be as many as 15 or 17, according to some estimates. So the lesson of allowing Iraq to get away with these weapons for so long was that a bunch of other countries said, well, look, if Iraq can get away with it, why shouldn't we? It's an inexpensive way of creating a weapon of mass destruction.
Were you surprised to find that chemical weapons were used in the Balkan War?
Very much so. There have been news reports of that very recently. I should say I'm surprised to have learned about the fact at this stage, because it wasn't commonly known until now. But in the context of knowing that other countries have been developing these weapons, I guess one shouldn't be surprised. One can be very distressed and disappointed about it, because it's yet another nail in the coffin of keeping these weapons away from a civilized society.
Well, war is pretty repugnant as it is, and all death is pretty miserable, and certainly death during wars is pretty awful. Why are biological and chemical weapons considered more repugnant than other methods of killing in war?
That's a very good question. I mean, obviously, to a person who is killed, whether by a bullet or a bacterium, it's not going to make much difference, assuming that they don't suffer too much or extensively, or you can suffer as well from a bullet that causes infection and you'll die from it. For reasons that are not entirely clear, chemical and biological weapons, or as they had been called throughout history, poisons, were pretty much taboo. They were always seen as beyond the legitimate pale of use. And this is cross-cultural. Cultures that extended from the Middle East, the times of the Romans, and in Greek society, poisons were seen as just not legitimate in warfare. And this carried through the Middle Ages. Using poisons were considered was considered unchivalrous, right through the last century or two, when philosophers and lawyers, international lawyers who wrote the rules of warfare, said poisons are out of bounds. Now, this doesn't mean that poisons were not used. They certainly were. But they had, and they still do, have a certain moral taint or immoral taint that other weapons don't have. This is seen perhaps because they're sneaky. Sometimes they may not be seen as quite as useful because they can be indiscriminate. I mean, if you spray a poison around now, it's not quite clear who's going to get the effect, as opposed to the bullet, which you presumably will aim at a particular person. But for whatever the reasons, we have had a long-standing taboo about the use of these kinds of weapons for thousands of years. And as I say, not only in the Western world. And we've been able to exploit that for the goodness of mankind. There is a treaty called the Biological Weapons Convention, a treaty since 1972 that does ban biological weapons. And the treaty uses a very interesting expression. It says that these weapons are repugnant to the conscience of mankind. And they do have a certain special repugnance and abhorrence that I think we ought to be exploiting, let alone the opposite, which we seem to be doing, allowing people to get away with the use of these kinds of weapons.
Leonard Cole is my guest. He's the author of the new book, The 11th Plague, The Politics of Biological and Chemical Warfare. Let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. back with Leonard Cole, the author of the new book, The 11th Plague, The Politics of Biological and Chemical Warfare. The U.S. military actually conducted tests in America of biological warfare using some chemical agents as well. And this was in the years of 1949 to 1969. And some of these tests were conducted in populated areas without the knowledge of the American public. How did these tests come to light?
An enterprising reporter got a hint that there might have been a couple of tests back in the 1950s. And reported this in 1976, so many years after the fact, and he had cited the possibility, as he understood it, that maybe San Francisco was targeted by the Army, and during which time the Army sprayed certain bacteria and chemicals around the city of San Francisco, and there were two or three other places that he named. Since that time, we've learned, and in fact the Army has acknowledged, that at least 239 open-air tests over populated areas were conducted during that 20-year period between 1949 and 1969. And chemicals and biological agents, that is bacteria, were released over populated areas to the extent that probably millions and millions of Americans were exposed, that they were unwitting guinea pigs in these experiments.
And there were Senate hearings on these experiments in 1977?
That's correct. There were, and that's when the American public first learned the full extent of these experiments.
Tell us about one or two of these experiments in populated areas. How about the one in the New York City subway?
Yes, that has a certain drama to it. In fact, it kind of recapitulated in my mind about a year ago after the sarin incident in the Tokyo subway system. In 1966, for a six-day period, during peak travel hours, the Army had arranged that bacteria called Bacillus subtilis, mixed with some chemical particles, would be released by way of stacking them in light bulbs, and an agent from the Army, a technical person, would come down to the subway platform while there were many, many passengers and people on trains in transit, others waiting on the platform, drop a light bulb filled with these bacteria on the track as the train was coming into the station. Then there were detector apparatuses placed around to measure concentrations of these bacteria and particles at some distance and some time after the release of these. And the determination was that virtually everybody who was in the subway system during these peak traffic hours were breathing in these materials. They were exposed to them. And had these bacteria been highly lethal and highly pathogenic, or that is, biological weapons, that tens of thousands, if not millions of people could have become ultimately infected and perhaps died. I might add that the Bacillus subtilis was seen by the Army, or at least declared by the Army, as harmless. The truth is that no bacterium under some conditions is necessarily harmless. You concentrate a heavy dose of this stuff and push it into somebody's face, especially a person who has a weak immune system or a very old person, a very young person. They're called compromised hosts. People can get sick and sometimes die from these bacteria as well.
So what were the Army's conclusions based on the test?
The Army's conclusions were that if certain more lethal bacteria had been sprayed and released in exactly the same way they managed to release these relatively harmless bacteria, that perhaps millions of people could have been infected and died.
Now, there was a class action suit that was recently filed in Minneapolis as a result of some test spraying of a chemical agent over an elementary school in 1953. And there's a scientific investigation into this, and the results are due soon. Actually,
yes.
In January, I think the report will be released by the National Academy of Sciences
right,
on this test spraying. Yeah, well, tell us what happened here in 1953.
This is also interesting how often enough, I mean, we've known about this in the public, that is, the information about these tests has been available to the public since the late 70s, and I've written about it periodically by way of articles, op-ed pieces, then a book, actually, in the late 80s. And yet, each time the information comes out and is broadcast, so many people say they didn't know about it before. The tests about Minneapolis were known and understood as far back as the early 1980s. And yet, many people in this town of Minneapolis first learned about them after a television series that was presented in this town of Minneapolis discussed them in 1994, just 2.5 years ago. One of the tests that was involved with a chemical called zinc cadmium sulfide involved spraying many areas in the city of Minneapolis. And the effort, by the way, of these tests, the purpose behind all of these tests was to see if these chemicals would spread and how effective they might be if they were really toxic materials, highly toxic materials. And one of the targeted areas was the Clinton Elementary School. And several middle-aged people who at the time in 1953 were young children in the school felt that they may have had harmful effects. They felt disproportionate numbers of incidents of cancer and problems with kidneys and livers. And in a way, it reminds me of the Gulf War syndrome question. Yes, zinc cadmium sulfide could very well have been the cause of toxic problems that the people ultimately suffered. But to prove that this was the case and is the case is going to be very difficult, especially since these tests were done in the early 50s. So you're talking about more than 40 years after the fact. But hundreds of former Clinton students, Clinton Elementary students, got together, and they have been seeking to institute a suit and certainly to look for more information and urge that the government produce information. One of their senators, Senator Paul Wellstone, and the congressman who represents Minneapolis, who is named Martin Szabo, were able to get a $1 million appropriation through Congress that funded an investigation that has been going on for nearly 2 years by a committee of the National Academy of Sciences to see what the possible health effects of exposure to zinc cadmium sulfide might be. And that report, as you said, is supposed to be out sometime in late January.
Leonard Cole teaches at Rutgers University and is the author of The 11th Plague, The Politics of Biological and Chemical Warfare. We'll talk more in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the U.S. military's current biological weapons program. We continue our discussion with Leonard Cole, author of The 11th Plague. Also, Man Becomes Painting. We talk with artist Jim Dine about his work from his happenings of the early 60s to his botanical paintings. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Leonard Cole, author of The 11th Plague, The Politics of Biological and Chemical Warfare. When we left off, he was telling us about how the U.S. military conducted tests of biological and chemical agents on unsuspecting Americans from 1949 to 69. Does the American military have a biological weapon and chemical weapon experimentation program now?
Well, we do have. In the case of biological weapons, we've already forsworn our arsenal. In 1969, President Nixon said that he was eliminating the entire offensive capability of the United States in the area of biological weapons. And in 1972, we became parties, or we signed a treaty called the Biological Weapons Convention, and we're parties to it. We're leaders in it. So to the best of my knowledge, we have no offensive biological program. We don't have any stockpiles of bacteria or viruses that we would attack others with. On the other hand, we do have an active defensive program. And the defensive program means we try to develop vaccines or antibiotics or protective gear. The truth is, and you'll hear this from any Pentagon spokesman, that in order to test the effectiveness of any of these defensive programs, you do need some kind of lethal weapon, that is, a dangerous biological agent. And while we keep them in small quantities, presumably, we need them around so that we can test the effectiveness of what we're trying to defend against. The footnote to this, and maybe it should be the headline rather than the footnote, that unlike any other weapon system, since bacteria and viruses can reproduce and reproduce very quickly, if you have a very small number of biological agents around, within a week or two, you can have a huge arsenal of them. I mean, just to give you a quick idea, a single bacterium can divide every 20 minutes when it's given the right nourishment. And if you do some math or take a calculator out, you're going to see that if a bacterium can become 2 in 20 minutes and 4 in 40 minutes and continue to double, you will discover that from that single bacterium, at the end of about 10 hours, you can have a billion. So you can imagine how many billions and trillions and zillions of these bacteria can be developed in a very short time. So the watchword is that even with an honorably or an honorable defensive program, the potential for developing a dangerous arsenal is there, and one has to be on guard against that.
World War I was the war in which chemical weapons were used first and most extensively. How were they used in World War I, and what were they? What were the chemicals?
Yes. In World War I, or in 1914, and then in 15, Germany was the first to introduce a chemical attack, a large-scale chemical attack. I mean, poisons had been used here and there throughout history, but by way of compressing chlorine gas into cylinders, the Germans waited for a certain wind pattern to develop when they were in the trenches near the French, and this was in Ypres in Belgium. And when the wind was right on a sunny afternoon in April of 1915, some 6,000 of these cylinders of chlorine gas were opened up, and when the wind was to the backs of the Germans, and of course, therefore, coming at the face to the face of the French troops who were some hundreds of yards away. And the recording of the time was that these troops were watching a strange yellow-green cloud come at them. And this gas hovered close to the ground. And they didn't run away from it because they didn't know what it was. It was just a kind of strange effect as they were perhaps mesmerized by it. By the time the gas got to them, they were enveloped and started frothing at the mouth and bleeding, choking, gasping, many of whom died. But that was just the beginning. That was the introduction. And then a variety of other chemical agents were used during the next few years of the war, culminating in 1917 with the Germans' use of mustard gas, which is still considered an effective chemical weapon. Although I must say that recent reports about Bosnia and its use of chemical weapons in the past couple of years against the Serbs indicated that they might have used chlorine gas as well, by packing chlorine into some kind of warheads and then shooting out these warheads at the enemy troops.
And the mustard gas causes extensive blistering of the skin?
Blistering of the skin, blindness, and you would be inhaling it, so therefore your lungs would be burned as well. It's a horrible death. I mean, it was largely because of mustard, which had that reputation immediately after World War I, that the world became so disgusted about the effects of chemical agents, or gas as it was then known, that the international treaty came to pass in 1925, the Geneva Protocol.
What treaties now govern the use of biological and chemical weapons, and what is their status?
The two most important treaties are, one, the Biological Weapons Convention, which was first put on the table in 1972. Now there are 139 nations, including the United States, that are part of that treaty. It bans not only the use of biological weapons, but even research or production of them, so that they're pretty much banned from the earth, at least technically by treaty. But there's no way to confirm or verify that countries aren't cheating. The new Chemical Weapons Convention, which was just put on the table for signature in 1993 and now has 160 nations that have signed, including the United States, would not only ban chemical weapons from the earth, it has provisions for on-site inspection, so that if a country thinks that another country is cheating, an outside inspectorate must be available to come in within 24 or 36 hours or so after the charge is made and see on-site whether there's any illegal activity going on. I might say that the United States has signed that treaty, but it is not ratified. It requires 2/3 vote of our Senate in order to ratify. And the Senate was supposed to vote on this in mid-September. Unfortunately, 24 hours before the vote was supposed to take place, then-candidate Bob Dole said that he felt that the treaty was not quite verifiable and would be costly, and he didn't think that it ought to be ratified at that point. And many moderate Republicans, who before had said that they would intend to ratify, decided that they better not cross their party leader at the time. So we're faced with this situation, that the treaty will go into force. 65 nations have already ratified. That's the number that says that the treaty will go into force, and that's going to be in April of next year. If the U.S. is not party to that treaty, we will be setting a terrible example for the rest of the world, suggesting that maybe we don't take chemical weapons seriously enough. So I would hope that we're going to see some early action on the part of the Senate.
Leonard Cole, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure to be with you.
Leonard Cole teaches at Rutgers University and is the author of The 11th Plague, The Politics of Biological and Chemical Warfare. Coming up, artist Jim Dine. This is Fresh Air. Jim Dine moved to New York in the late 50s and helped shake up the art world. Along with Klaus Oldenburg, he created what became known as happenings, theater events that were forerunners of performance art. He created visual arts from found objects in the trash and was considered one of the early pop artists. But he's gone through many phases since then, taking inspiration from the natural world, classical art, and his own dreams. A retrospective called The Body and Its Metaphors is now touring Japan. A series of recent paintings is on view at the Pace Wildenstein Gallery in Manhattan. He created the series while living in Berlin. The paintings were inspired by a dream he had in Paris about an owl and a crow. He told me about his personal associations with these birds.
In America, crows, unhappily, are called Jim, you know? And so am I. And as when I was a kid, there was a crow at the zoo who would speak to me, literally, because you can teach crows to talk a little bit, and it would speak to me. But fortunately, when it spoke to me, I was 5 years old or 4 years old, it would say, "Hello, Jimmy," which is what my family called me. And it was very important to me. And I also am aware of ravens and crows everywhere I go. I'm extremely interested in them and what they can do, their habits of playing and tricksterism and their intelligence. The owl was, Athena's friend, and the owl in the dream was very much a female and an important presence to me.
Mm-hmm. You grew up in Cincinnati, arrived in New York in the late 1950s. What did you find most interesting about New York and what you were seeing in terms of art in New York when you got there?
I came to New York because it seemed to me the only place that what I had in my mind to do could take place. It certainly could not have taken place in Cincinnati, a provincial city, a very pretty city, but a provincial city. And New York was, after all, the home of abstract expressionism. And those people, when I in the 50s, thrilled me.
But you weren't doing abstract expressionist work, were
you? I was a kid trying to find my way.
When you got to New York, you co-founded the Judson Gallery with the artist Klaus Oldenburg. What did you want from this gallery?
We just wanted to be famous.
Did you think the gallery would do it for you?
We wanted a venue for our work. And, you know, we were young guys. And we were not interested in being part of the generation ahead of us.
Was it at the Judson Gallery that you created your happenings?
Yes, that's where we made our performances, there and at the Rubin Gallery, which sort of went along hand in hand with it.
Happenings became a kind of demoneyed word. Everything became a happening. What was it when you were doing it?
It was never our word. It was Alan Kaprow's word. And what we considered what we were doing was the artist theater.
The art as theater?
No, the artist's theater.
Mm-hmm.
And or the painter's theater, whatever. That's what we thought that of it as that. But obviously, performance was in the air, and there were few people doing it, including Klaus and I, Red Grooms, and Bob Whitman. And it was essentially theater. It was not painting or sculpture, although it had some of those elements because we were painters and sculptors.
Could you give us a sense of what one of those performances was like?
Well, I made a piece. The first one I made at the Judson was an evening of performances with Oldenburg and Capro, and I forget who else. We also were involved with dancers at the time, people who were dancing with Cunningham or had studied with Merce Cunningham and Cage. And there was a lot of that on the program, too. My performance the first time was called The Smiling Workman. And there was a canvas with a light on it in the center of the stage or the center of the room. And it was a black canvas that had some white handprints on it. And I came out and I was made up as a man with a red face and a black mouth. And I started to paint on the canvas some more with the white paint and the red paint. And finally, I drank the paint and threw myself through the canvas. And that was that. And to hear about it is not the same thing as seeing it, obviously. It was very fast, and it was extremely effective.
Was it real paint that you drank?
No, it was tomato juice.
Good. I don't think you'd be here to be telling
us
about it.
Exactly. I wouldn't be 61.
So this is like the man becomes the art. The man becomes the painting.
It was also that, and also it was about the obsession of working.
Mm-hmm.
It was called The Smiling Workman.
And you were pretty obsessive.
Still am.
Right. Now, why did you want to get into the performance aspect of art?
It was a natural extension of what was in the air and of what we were doing. We were making, all of us were using found objects from the street, and it seemed to be the natural progression.
Yeah, you actually went around picking the trash with Klaus Oldenburg, didn't you?
Yeah, we did. We did.
What were you looking for? What was considered a good find?
We were just, it had to strike you, you know, just when you saw it. We brought a lot of trash out, I can tell you. But, you know, New York is fabulous for that. Still is.
Would you take something that was visually interesting, even if it was smelly?
I guess so. It was winter. That was easier.
The smelly stuff doesn't grow
right.
as easily.
It was easier.
Now, give us an example of one of your works that came out of picking the trash.
Well, I mean, I found the canvas that I dove through, for instance, on the street. It was probably been used at a theater as a flat. Or, you know, we would find wheels and pieces of wood. We didn't have any money. You know, I was teaching grade school, and he was a librarian at Cooper Union. And we were using this stuff as materials. So there was a lot of wood that we brought. You'd find a baby carriage, you know, and stuff it with wood and take it back to the Judson and just keep on building.
Did you feel like you were getting far away from painting while you were doing this?
Yes, I did.
And did that bother you?
Yes, I stopped making the performances finally. It bothered me, the publicness of it.
The publicness of the performance aspect?
Yes. I mean, I'm always torn that way anyway. I have a deep reclusive side, although I can be gregarious. And it disturbed me that I felt, and I still feel, that I was put here for this solitary activity. And the crowds were starting to like it too much for me. So I backed out after a year and a half.
Now, something else that you did early in your work, you did a series based on tools. And
I still do.
You still
I still use tools. I mean, they're part of my life because, I mean, of my childhood in my grandfather's store. And
hardware store. Your grandfather had a hardware store.
But also with my grandfather. I had a big connection to my grandpa, and he had tools around him at all the time. He wasn't a particularly good craftsman, but he loved to work. And he made them available to me from the time I was about 2 years old. So they were always with me. And I never saw them necessarily as just objects of, you know, to work with. But I saw them as beautiful objects, sculpture, primary objects, things that, anonymous sculpture that developed because somebody wanted to work. So it came from, it was the extension of some guy's hand. And I still find there's a great romance in these tools.
Did you use them at all, these wrenches? And...
Oh, yeah, I do. I mean, I use them anyway. I mean, I like working with my hands. Not absurdly.
When you decided that the performances were too public and you didn't want to do them anymore,
right,
what did you do, and how did your painting change at that time?
Well, it gave me more time to... when I decided that, I also was, at that time, teaching school, and a dealer offered me the same salary that I was making teaching grade school if I would paint and then give her the paintings. So I was, with alacrity, jumped at that. And so it changed because I had more time to concentrate.
My guest is artist Jim Dine. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with artist Jim Dine. You have a series I really love of flowers and plants,
mm-hmm.
your botanical series. Mm-hmm. When did you turn to that, and what
led you
to it?
Well, all my life I have. My mother and my grandmother had a great feeling for flowers and the earth. And my grandma was a kind of farm lady, and she just gave me this feeling for growing things. And then I married a woman who has this strange connection to plants. So,
a strange connection to plants?
Yeah, it's it's strange in the sense that it's not the usual connection to plants, in that it's not necessarily growing. She's just truly connected to plants, so that she looks at them very closely and has taught me many things about them physically. And I'm always drawing plants. I mean, it's not a question of a series. It's something, it's a theme that goes through my life and still is.
Now, I hope you don't mind my bringing this up. I know that your mother passed away when you were 15.
No, I was 12.
Oh, even younger.
Yeah.
So did you feel stranded without her?
Totally. I was shipwrecked. And it was a cruel trick. And informed and colored my whole life. And left me extremely lonely. But I have, through help, been able to get through this veil of tears, as they say.
You'd been very close with her?
Yes, I was very close with her.
And with your father?
No, I was not very close with my father.
Had she been sick?
Yes. She died of cancer.
So you,
and she had been sick for about 4 years. And before that, she was obsessed with getting cancer. So it was just like, and for a little kid, it was like, I couldn't believe this. I was always hearing about it. And then suddenly she got it, and then she was dead.
Wow. Did that give you a feeling that premonitions, bad premonitions really come
all
true?
That stuff, all that stuff.
Oh. You know. Did you worry about your own health after that?
Yeah, sure. But I worried, I'm more worried about, what I really worried about was how the hell was I going to get through this world?
Well, who helped you?
Well, my grandma did. I went to live with my grandma. And she was that was my mother's mother. She had always been this source of absolute pure love for my brother and I. And she really came through. I mean, she was just there for me in high school. And she helped me a lot.
Was this the grandmother on the hardware side of the family or
yes,
the other side of the
family? Yes, that was the hardware side of the family.
So,
she was the one who had the relationship to the plants, too.
Oh. So feeling kind of abnormal to begin with, this sense was probably, what, even more heightened when you didn't have your mother anymore.
Exactly. And it made it... It was like an amputation, and it suddenly I was without a young life. I had to grow up or do something to just to get my head above water.
Did your mother tell you that you should expect that she wouldn't be there much longer? And did she give you advice, try to leave
absolutely
you with
not.
Words of wisdom?
Absolutely
she,
no? not. No, absolutely not. It was all denial. My brother and I weren't even allowed to go to the funeral, so... it was a very curious way to say goodbye.
Why weren't you allowed to go?
I mean, there was some talk that my father said that, you know, it wouldn't be good for the kids. I don't know. It was a very poor decision and one that affected my brother and I tremendously through the years.
Did you end up in a lot of therapy after all of this?
Oh, well, I mean, I'm highly analyzed.
Are you?
Oh, yeah. Forever.
Do you think that's been helpful?
Tremendous. That and painting saved me.
Right. Gee, I imagine when you do a self-portrait, it becomes pretty loaded.
Well, yeah, I guess so. But when I do anything, it's pretty loaded because I'm still bringing the same stuff to it. Someone said that most things are self-portraits anyway, and I pretty much believe that.
I believe you have dyslexia?
Yes.
Which is makes it difficult.
Well, whatever it is, you know. I mean, it could be called that, but I think now it's much more specific what people have, you know. But in my day, when I was a kid in school, I was called stupid because I couldn't concentrate. And it was both psychological and physical.
So you found it hard to read?
Very.
Did that help keep you more comfortable in the visual world? Were you, in other words,
I hear what you're saying.
What I'm asking is this, is whatever problem that you had that made it difficult to read, did that problem follow you into the visual world, or were you
no.
free of that problem?
I was absolutely free of that problem,
mm-hmm.
But I missed not reading, and it really aggravated me and really frustrated me, and when I turned about 23 years old, I never looked back. I just started to read. And forced myself to, and I still do. I mean, I read every day, but I read in different ways. Some days I'm able to read just like everyone else. Other days I read backwards. Other days I start the book backwards. I do what is necessary to get through the book and enjoy it or to get something from it.
What did you want out of art as a young man compared to what you want out of it now at the age of 61?
Uh-huh. That's a good question. As a young man, I really didn't know what I wanted. I just worked, and I worked at it, and I was gifted, and so I made some things that were pretty good looking at times. I want much more for it now. I want something in that's more like a symphony rather than chamber music. I want a big vault.
Does that mean working on a larger canvas too?
Not necessarily, but that too. But I know it means working and seeing clearly, and being. I'm very ambitious for my work, what I can do, and so therefore, I mean, these paintings at Pace now, to me, are. I'm rarely satisfied, but I worked on them so long and so slowly. And so I kept going back to them, and they mean a lot to me. And I'm right now, there's nothing much I'd change in them. I mean, in a year or so, maybe.
Some of the paintings at Pace now are large, and they require a lot of physical effort. You know, like
I'm very physical.
Yeah, you're pounding and knocking and
well,
they're,
grinding.
They're
and
big.
Things.
I mean, they're taller than you are.
Yeah, there's a lot to do. Yeah, mm-hmm. Well, most things are taller than I am, but. I lived with them very closely in Berlin and slept with them, and literally, I mean, in the same room, so that I knew them very well. It was a very intimate experience painting them.
Jim Dine's show of recent paintings is at the Pace Wildenstein Gallery in Manhattan. His retrospective, The Body and Its Metaphors, is touring Japan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Joan Tui Westman. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Chris Fraley, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.